Thank you for joining this afternoon's program of At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. It is the 30th of November, and I'm your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, broadcasting live out of Roberta's restaurant in Brooklyn. And our sponsor today, a thank you to The Barter House, who is proud to support the Heritage Radio Network and its community of food lovers. The Barter House works with family vineyards and small bottlers from around the world to bring only the finest and most flavorful wines to market. Committed to sustainable agriculture and artisanal production, the Barter House offers outstanding wines at a wide range of price points to retailers, restaurateurs, and private collectors. To learn more about the Barter House, please visit them on the web at www.thebarterhouse.com or call them at 917-463-3076. And we'll start today's show with a week in wine recap and good news for the Tuscan island of Elba. Elba's most emblematic and symbolic wine, Elba Aglietico Passito, has been slated to become the 8th Tuscan DOCG in a matter of days. It will be labeled as both Elba Aglietico Passito and Aglietico Passito d'Elba. The new DOCG represents recognition for viticultural practices that have been employed since the Etruscan era. They flourished during the Middle Ages when wine was transported through Pisa to all parts of Tuscany. Today, there are 250 hectares planted to vine on the island of Elba, with roughly 160 hectares authorized for production of DOC wines. With tourism boost of the post-war era, Elba's viticulture experienced a dramatic decline, and the surface area planted to vine decreased sharply. This trend has been reversed in recent years, and both the quantity and quality of wines produced there has grown. Aglietico d'Elba Passito, made from Aglietico grapes, dried for at least 10 days, is the island's viticultural gem, as my recent tasting of roughly 60 Elba wines, reports Franco Ziliani, included a dozen bottlings made from the grape itself. And in the crop report, we go to Spain. Like many parts of Western Europe, Spain experienced a cool growing season in 2010. But since the country is one of the hottest and driest in the region, the cool weather was a boon, allowing fruit to gradually ripen. Bodegas in the northern part of the country believe their wines will taste ripe, but show elegance as well. And the stage was set for the year's growing season's last harvest when a frost in Rioja dropped the leaves off the vine while fruit was still being picked. In both Rioja and Ribera del Duero, rainstorms during flowering reduced yields. The Bodega Muga says their older vineyards had the lowest yields he has seen, but the small amounts made ripening easier and made loose bunches help prevent mildew. The end of the season was similarly perfect in Rioja. Summer was dry and warm with an excellent contrast of temperatures between day and night, says Muga. The harvest was done in good conditions and the first fermentations developed a great aroma. Even Galicia, which can suffer from extreme humidity, enjoyed a long dry summer and bodegas were reporting record yields. And moving into the market feed, news has been fervently circulating this past month about the harmful effects of alcoholic energy drinks. The FDA issued warning letters to four companies earlier this month saying that drinks were unsafe. The agency said the combination of caffeine and alcohol in drinks can lead to a wide awake drunk and have led to alcohol poisoning, car accidents, and assaults. Charge Beverages and New Century Brewing said they no longer are producing their alcoholic energy drinks, and at least four states have banned the beverages. We're going to take a short break and be back with my guests this afternoon, who've come all the way from the Lower East Side, Ben Towle and Phil Windsor from the Fat Radish Restaurant. Welcome back to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. And you're listening to a new song that Knife Show, who are producers Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener, just put out. So that song is being debuted today. So thanks, Jack, for sharing that with us. And a welcome to my guests, Phil Windsor and Ben Towell. How are you doing today?
Very good.
Good.
Very excited to be here.
Yeah, great.
The first time was Roberta's was a couple years ago, no?
A couple years ago. It felt the first time we came here, it was like...
Going on holiday.
Yeah, we described it as it was like a mini break. We just started our business. And we just couldn't believe we were sat here in Bushwick and having the discussions that we were having. And we just thought we were the coolest, saddest individuals in the room.
It was the first time I left Manhattan. I was blown away.
Yeah. Was it?
Still talk about it 2 years later.
I have to say, I think Brooklyn sometimes does feel that way, though, from Manhattan. It is a nice... cool, a nice piece that you can, you know, look forward to at the end of the day or in your next morning.
Yeah, no, it's like a mini break.
It's a mini break.
Especially out here.
Yeah, especially out here. Well, cool.
Yeah, it's very, very cool.
So when you were here, you had just started a catering company called Silkstone.
Foolishly, yeah. And we started a couple of years ago. And I think we came here to, I think you introduced us to people. It was about, we were talking about sourcing products for the catering and seeking advice from people wiser than ourselves in the food industry, and it's been a crazy couple of years doing that.
So. Well, tell us what's been latest in your world.
Well, we recently, 6 weeks ago now, opened the Fat Radish on Orchard Street. Yes, that's been our new project, our restaurant.
Restaurant, okay, very cool.
Yep.
And so it's Orchard, and I had the pleasure of working with you on the wine list, so I will just say that up front, because I do know quite a bit about the restaurant.
Aaron, you know everything about it. You probably know more than us about the restaurant. Exactly. The idea was always to try and do a restaurant, but the first thing we started with was catering, just because it was a thing we could start out of our apartment at the time, very difficult to do a restaurant out of it. And then it was an amazing way of like getting to know the city and getting to know people and like ironing out like kinks and I think very glad that the way it happened was, you know, we sort of did 2 years of running a catering business before the restaurant.
Now you have opened on what some people are calling the last frontier of Manhattan.
Lochai.
Yeah. People still get lost finding it.
But it's good. That area is definitely...
Yeah, it's amazing.
We spent a long time looking at different areas. And
how many restaurants do you reckon we looked at?
We looked at 60. And the Fat
60
Radish
spaces.
Was number 58 of 60.
All right.
60.
So,
I hadn't been to that area, really, before that much.
No. Since then, we've learned the tip our landlord gave us was always looking, and now I know this, was looking dry cleaners. When you're looking for a restaurant, go to the local dry cleaner and look at the shirts and the clothes are in there. So what are people going to be like in the neighborhood? And I thought, and that's very true of Orchard Street.
Really?
Yeah. It's all Chinese, like, it's like wholesale places, hosiery. So the only real way you get an idea of what actually happens at nighttime in the area, because everyone's at work.
Yeah.
Is you go and look at the dry cleaners and see what people, you know, the demographic people. So it's
interesting. Yeah, to keep
top
that in mind
tip.
Next time.
Top tip.
Yeah. So here you've opened in a space that was once in its day a Chinese sausage factory, right?
Yeah.
Yep. And I know your concept is quite different than that. So tell us, our listeners, a bit about what you've created.
Well, our idea was basically to make vegetables, you know, to start coming up with dishes by starting with vegetables rather than starting with meats. And you know, one of the sort of food philosophies that we have is eating a bit like, you know, the sort of makeup of your teeth almost is how we look at it. It's like 60% vegetable, 60% grains, 30% sort of vegetables, and then, you know, we have sort of 10% is for eating meat in our mouth. So we look at it a little bit like that. It's sort of a macrobiotic, that's a macrobiotic philosophy, which we sort of came up, you know, we sort of drew influence from that. And so we, you know, we have a lot of vegetable dishes, but without, like, you know, it's not a vegetarian restaurant.
No.
But it's making the vegetables a bit more of the focal point.
Focal point, yeah, exactly.
On the play.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than sort of an afterthought. And you know, and just sourcing things. You know, it also allows us for like a price point to be much better. So yeah, that was the idea behind the restaurant.
Well, it's certainly in line with the philosophy you started with Silkstone as well. And I've seen several articles, at least in the past month, kind of pointing to this trend of vegetables. And it's wild because it's like, well,
we couldn't even coin a phrase and someone did it. We kept telling us for years that you've got to think of a word. There was a piece, I think New York Magazine was it.
New York Magazine, yep. And then there's been other ones kind of as a retort to that in some kind of, you can't call vegetables a trend necessarily. So.
No, exactly.
It's ridiculous that people...
I think actually, and that goes back a little bit about what you and I found about, you eat out so much in Manhattan and never more than when we sort of didn't, you know, I wasn't working in a restaurant and, you know, we sort of had evenings off and we weren't catering. And it was like, you eat out so much. And I think you begin to like just crave what you would make for yourself at home. But you don't really have kitchens if you live in Manhattan to do it. So the restaurant has a lot of that, like coming up with dishes that we would either make for ourselves at home or that we want to eat because that's what you want to eat on a Monday and that's what you'd make for yourself, but with a slightly more refined.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was a lot. We eat out so much in New York that sometimes you just crave.
That's a good point. Yeah, simple. You can't do the hearty and rich 7 days
a week. Yeah.
Yeah, it was driving me mad in Manhattan. You had the theme.
We only went to
you had to go for Italian, Chinese.
Yeah, and every dish might have had bacon or something pork related.
Nothing wrong with that,
but it does catch up to you, especially when you pass the age of 30. Just as a forewarning. I'm kidding. So a little bit about your background, which kind of also then gives the food above and beyond vegetables its spin, I'd say. I mean, you both are from the countryside in England.
Yep.
We grew up as friends together, just outside Oxford, in the middle of nowhere. So we spend a lot of time together. And then
Phil is a huge romantic, and I just say before he starts his story. And
I was going to go into our personal. I was going to leave that one behind. But it was an amazing place to grow up. And kind of the countryside in England, which we're going to get onto in a bit, is incredible. And what's coming out of there is fantastic. And it's very kind of ahead of its time, really.
And
not behind.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was, and I suppose England's got incredible. It's very regional, and there's a lot of like traditions in England that Phil is a big advocate of like, I think like British traditions and
damn right
stuck in his ways. So that really exists, and there is like this, and you've really, that's something you bring a lot to like. And when we're talking about food and dishes, Phil has this like repertoire of like British classics that.
Yeah, name some of them.
Phil Clancy.
I mean, we're going to Coronation Chicken.
Coronation Chicken, okay.
Phil's potato salad is pretty amazing, I have to say.
If you take someone on one of my picnics in the summer with the English classics. Love it.
Weak at the knees.
I love it.
And there's people listening who's had one of Phil's picnics. They should.
Call in at 718-497-2128. So some of the dishes out at the Fat Radish have this lean towards some of the traditions from British cuisine then.
They do.
Yeah.
It's celery root pot pie.
Uh-huh.
Pot pie.
Like this idea, okay, that, no, actually... Firstly, the best example is we have a cauliflower salad at the moment, and the idea behind this is actually from one of the dishes Phil just mentioned, Coronation Chicken.
Okay.
Right? Coronation Chicken is like chicken with yogurt and is it mango or apricot?
It's like apricot. It's like a curry.
It's curry chicken with
like chutney
yogurt.
kind of sort. Okay.
It tastes much better than it sounds.
And it is delicious, but you just couldn't put it on anywhere and be taken seriously. Well, you could. Anyway, we took the idea of, you know, okay, so we had cauliflower, you know, they were in season, we could get loads of different varieties, they look amazing, And cauliflower is a little bit of an afterthought, I think, as a vegetable. Like
I agree with that.
Cauliflower just
You see it more these days as pickled, but you know, the other day I think I had that dish had three different colored cauliflowers on the plate. It was beautiful.
Thing of beauty.
Yes.
I mean, I would say the cauliflower is really represents what British cooking is, like the sort of reputation British cooking has. They just don't have good press. Anyway, so we've done that and we've taken it with curry powder and all those things that make a Coronation chicken delicious. Like we take sheep's milk yogurt, we take apricot puree, curry powder, and then we just roast the cauliflower and have this dressing, and then we have crispy shallots and raw cauliflower, and it's a really exciting, interesting way to get cauliflower back on track.
Yeah,
making it the center of attention. It does convert people back onto cauliflower.
Yeah, I mean,
a lot of people like look at the menu and go, I'm not going to touch that. They eat it and it's their favorite thing.
Well, we were talking a bit about before the show started too, just with the lean towards the focus on vegetables as the primary component of the dish, and then how that also relates to, you know, pairing situations with either some of the cocktails that you have on the list or with the wines. And I think you had mentioned something really interesting when you think about the sauce or the preparation of that, as opposed, first and foremost, as driving the pairing as opposed to the actual product itself.
Yeah, exactly. The interesting training as a chef, I remember very clearly, and fortunate enough to work in some really good restaurants. And when a vegetarian would come in, it would like throw everyone. It'd be like, I need one vegetarian dish. And everyone would be like, oh my, you know, they're cooking like amazing food. And no one could really come up with anything because it was like, you had to start thinking in a very different way. And so one of the things that we sort of encourage everyone in our team is to take a vegetable and then, as you just said, start thinking about like how, you know, how, work backwards, what can we do with that vegetable? So like bring it out, whether it be curry, whether it be, you know, we're doing this black garlic celery root pot pie.
Right. But that's the same way that I think about pairing wines with proteins. It's like, okay, well, is that sauce of, you know, of the green peppercorn the one that's accompanying the steak? Or is it, you know, a buttered cream sauce that's accompanying the halibut as opposed to an olive oil? And in that same way, I think people might get thrown off initially, like, oh, whoa, vegetables. But
it's the same
fundamental kind of
philosophy. Is it rich, heavy?
Yeah.
Is it a rich, heavy dish?
Spicy.
Exactly that. And you know, we sell like you did the list, it's brilliant.
Thanks.
No, it's a really cool really cool list, and we sell a lot of wines, and we're not like, you know, and that's sort of a testament to all those things that like people are into it, and you know, you have a bottle of wine and dishes that make you feel good, and not like you know and you can like you wake up the next day and you feel like I had, you know, not so heavy and
right, yeah, all well made, fresh, kind of, you know, interesting dishes that are more unique in their novelty, but at the same time really are like wholesome.
Exactly.
So it's not a
fad.
All
so simple. Every dish is, and as we were saying just now, it's making one vegetable the star of certain dishes rather than this big mess.
And also with you know, that certainly the idea is also that you can do it in a setting. I always think what we're talking about has always been put in a kind of, you know, when you talk about vegetables, you talk about healthy eating, you think like tie-dye, not a cool restaurant, not a good wine list, not good music.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been about, and it's not saying that doesn't exist. Like, you know, we've got a wicked venison dish and we have a cool duck dish and we have a brilliant, you know, cured meat plates. But the setting is not always like conducive to like fun and, you know, celebration and where you can have all that and still have like good healthy food. And I think that's what the Fat Radish is trying to do, is like take the things that we're talking about and put it in a really, you know, Phil designed the restaurant and it has that feeling of like, you know, it's a really cool spot to be able to go and enjoy that.
I think we approached it in exactly the same way as the menu when Ben and I were talking about the things we like, and, you know, with the design of it.
Yeah.
Just keep it simple, make it fun.
And your inspiration, as you mentioned, was from some books and some kind of images that you had in your head from Covent Gardens.
The old Covent Garden Market in London, I think, which is kind of this idea, very industrial, working man spot.
It's almost like if you were to go to the Boqueria in Barcelona and you're walking through the stalls and all of a sudden you have like a little pop-up stand to sit and eat and you get that dish that's coming from that stand, you carry on and there's just this whole community around you and it feels very organic and it's, and it's layout.
Indoors, outdoors, a little bit scrappy.
It's kind of it's heavy, you know, the materials are heavy, but it's very much softened up by kind of light colors in there on the walls and things like that.
Well, tomorrow I know you have an event coming up, and I want to talk a bit about that and kind of also hone in on some of the ideas between the differences between the way British people think of food and Americans think of food, or are they more similar than we think? So stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to At the Root of It. This is your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn with my guests today, Ben Towle and Phil Windsor from the Fat Radish Restaurant. And we're going to lead into this segment talking a bit about perceptions of British cuisine and American cuisine. And I know you have a lunch tomorrow, which is in conjunction with Rob Reese, I believe his name is, otherwise known as the Cotswold Chef.
Exactly. We've really nice guy. Met him for the first time today.
Doing incredible things.
Doing unbelievable things. He's out here looking, he's in charge of sort of turning around school meals in England and making kids eat better school lunches, and has come here to sort of work with that with New York State. And
So this is more than just a temporary visit. This is
he's over here doing
a little promotion of sorts.
What he's been doing is in England is amazing. I mean, he just touched on it today, and we're going to learn a lot more about it tomorrow. It's something Phil and I are seriously passionate about is actually having a voice for what's happening with school meals and like having access to sort of healthy, affordable food, and so it's awesome to be a part of that. And I think it's exciting. We're also talking about British food and where is British food right now, and he's highlighting and doing a sort of presentation about why it's sort of changing and how it has become. We have a terrible reputation, we get laughed at when Phil and I say what sort of food is it.
So do we. The Americans don't really have
that. There's the best way to think of it is imagine if you tell an English guy you're opening an American restaurant in England,
right?
Well, they're going to think it's a diner, or they're going to think it's a fast food chain,
right?
Or it's like burgers and fries.
Yeah.
So when we say we're opening an English restaurant, people would think
laughter,
like fish and chips, bangers and mash, and like all those things, that cliche. Whereas if you actually, having lived here for 6 years, and if we were asked the question like, what is American, like modern American cooking?
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with the perception, and the same with British cooking.
That's true.
So we reverse it, so we're sort of faced with that terrible press, we sort of have to fight our way out of it with friends like you who have radio stations.
Benj, I think you sum that up pretty well. I think British cuisine is considered not fresh. It's not seasonal. Seasonality is not something that you jump to thinking, oh, that's British cuisine. But I think, Ben, your view on...
Yeah, no, we basically, aubergine is tiny, and so it's very difficult to compare the two cuisines, because, you know, as a chef in England, you have, you know, you have sort of limited, not limited, but you have a very different, like, palette to work with in terms of, like, seasonal, like, local ingredients.
Yeah.
You know, everything comes from one, you know, the equivalent of, like, getting everything from New York State. And so, but British food is so regional, and the sort of movement of heritage foods and sort of returning to, like, classic tried and tested dishes and flavor combinations, but just focusing on quality ingredients, which has sort of happened so much. The Brits are that's their strong point. Like, mm-hmm, you know, we mm-hmm. do really, really good seasonal, local, regional cooking. And so I think going back to that and looking at some of those dishes and how they're done and just making them slightly better, a little bit like what we talked about earlier.
Oh. So there's a concerted effort to kind of redefine what that means.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the essence of, if you look at, like, this is what we're talking about, Rob, this morning. If you look at, like, French cooking, like, really simple, basic dishes. Well, the English have those things, you know, whether it be, you know, down in the southwest, you know, people making whatever it be, cheeses and ciders, and, you know, whether it be Cornish pasties or hot pots or terrines, whatever. People are doing that, and now they suddenly started to look back at how they did things and traditional ways of making stuff,
mm-hmm.
but with all the knowledge that we have today. So I think that's why it's become so good.
And I think that the press that, you know, Jamie Oliver has ignited, and yeah. Rob seemingly, yeah. and yourself following amongst that to really create embrace more of a sustainable yeah. food system for a larger
exactly.
audience.
And I always thought, I really think that in England there's some really, like, key figures who are leading that. And we've just had, I think you met them, the Sidgwicks. Who, when we were growing up, started, like, a farm co-op called called Cotswold Lamb. And it, like, never, it couldn't get off the ground because mm-hmm. none of the farmers were talking to one another. They all hate each other. Everyone's in such close proximity.
Yeah.
And suddenly that, like, started to shift, and they started, you know, and he was telling me, like, the growth that they've had and the restaurants that they're supplying and the cuts
in
that
the
they're
past
doing.
Yeah,
in
five
the last
years.
Like, 5 years.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a really exciting, supermarkets in England have really got behind sort of, you know, cooking, like, people starting to cook again.
Right.
So I think a whole nation, like, and I say very broadly, but people are really, I feel very excited. And, you know, if you look at the cooking television over there, like, the actual, like, quality and the substance of the shows, it's all about, like, good seasonal cooking and, like, yeah. cooking things that you
so
wouldn't
do. So there's a parallel between what's yeah. been happening in at least our,
in
you
the
know,
world, it's, and that's
in
what
our
happens in New York, yeah, exactly.
in New York and London and in the...
That's
yeah,
it. But
yeah.
I think London, I think England's happening on a slightly bigger scale because...
Yeah.
I think we're a bit more...
You
forward.
Get behind Hugh Ferning Whittance was a big name, but I don't think people would... I think people... I don't know how seriously people would take him here as a TV
sure,
show.
Sure, yeah.
River Cottage, but...
Don't know either.
It's a smaller place. I mean,
exactly.
I always
yeah.
think, I just remember when a kind of asparagus comes into season in the UK, my mother will use it for everything.
Yeah, everyone's.
For, like, the month it's there or right. the 2 months it's there.
Yeah.
And it moves up the country because it's smaller.
And that's
place.
Very European in a sense.
It's just
yeah.
everything is
yeah.
done with asparagus.
Yeah.
I mean, and you get sick of it by the end, and then something right. new comes in. And you're
so
using
that's
that
seasonal eating, which I think we've in America have gotten spoiled about, you know, having whatever we want whenever we want it.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of shifted in other places in the world too. But when you look at the size of Europe, and it makes sense that those things would really be celebrated within that month.
But I want to just to a little bit about how it's interesting how we see more, and we'll get the wine that's being served tomorrow. But the stuff that we that like things that are being produced in England are actually unbelievable. You see, like, cheddar, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's happened also. That's happened more and more here. But
yeah, like, there's a domestic
revival.
Yeah, revival.
Of small producers and we. Rob was telling us about how one of the supermarkets in England is getting behind leasing the butcher's counter.
Is it Waitrose or no? Because they seem to be making lots of news these days. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Sainsbury's.
We're
going
yeah.
to lease their butcher's areas to local cooperatives. So you could pull five farmers together and lease the meat counter at Sainsbury's through Wednesday.
All right.
I thought that's such a cool idea.
That is a very cool idea.
Very forward-thinking idea.
It's great. You mentioned it too. I mean, more and more eyes seem to be on England's wine country. I mean, we have a couple of producers. I know you've spent some time there, Phil, up at right?
Yeah, great friends of mine and Ben have a small vineyard just outside London in Sussex, West Sussex, which is coming. They're doing some amazing things.
Yeah, for sure.
We drank it the other day.
It
was delicious.
It's amazing, and I've been very fortunate enough to kind of spend summers down there and be part of harvesting, normally in the rain, kind of all day. It's not very glamorous, but amazing fun.
And then to
kind of see the whole process and then drink the wine.
Well, then tomorrow we're pouring the Ridgeview Estate, which has been celebrated, you know, year in, year out in the past 10 years with international trophies. And, you know, their production seems to be amongst a couple other vineyards in the area expanding over the next 5 years based on demand. And that is attributed to, I think, increased interest in domestic product and global warming, exactly, you know, a little bit, and just better winemaking techniques overall.
Yeah.
So, like Paul Roget and Louis Roeder, bigger champagne houses, have actually been kind of eyeing that region a bit.
Who would have thought you'd be drinking sparkling wine from?
Well, there's a lot of English people who don't even still really recognize that it's being made there.
No, of course not.
Yeah, I mean, if I didn't know you two, I probably wouldn't know. No, it's amazing. It really is.
Yeah, no.
So tomorrow then, before we wrap up, I want to just kind of point our listeners to any websites that you can share for your businesses.
We're going to tomorrow's stuff will be highlighted on our blog, our Silkstone NYC blog, and there'll be some sort of, we'll put together all the press coverage of that. The Fat Radish website is being built as we speak, and that'll be up at the end of next week.
But a holding page now exists for
www.thefatradishnyc.com.
Nice. Open 6 days.
We are open seven days.
7 days now.
Yeah.
Right.
For Monday, I know. We had to get out of
bed
on Monday.
No break for you two.
And for brunch now. Yeah.
Brunch, and so 7 days a week, and brunch is at the weekends.
Cool. Well, commend you for leading the charge on the trail, and especially in this market, which is pretty fierce, and with both the catering company and the restaurant. It's just grand success.
We are very grateful. Your support, an amazing list, and your approach to wines that has allowed to sort of have an incredible wine list and people not intimidated by wines in our restaurant, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining today.
Thanks.
That's really
and hope
fun.
To have you back another time.
We can't wait. It's been one of the best afternoons.
I'm all about it. I love the birthday.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks to our sponsor, The Barter House, who is proud to support the Heritage Radio Network and its community of food lovers. Thanks for listening. And you can listen to today's show on heritageradionetwork.com in our archives or via iTunes and iCast. See you next week. Thanks.